Although we do a lot of people here, so yes, hopefully thinking deep thoughts. But I thought it would be a wonderful opportunity to reintroduce a new member of the Planning Commission, who many of us have known for many years, who had retired and now has come back to help us. Booker DeVaughn has joined the Planning Commission. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Former president of, let's see, Three Rivers, Northwestern. Any others?
Yeah.
Acting at Capitol, that's right. So he knows a great deal, I was about to say. Indeed. So welcome. Glad to have you. I wonder, just for Booker's sake, if we could ask people to go around the room and introduce themselves and where they're from. It might help you. John, if you'll start, please.
John Shimo with the Metro Hartford Alliance.
Ben Barnes from OPM.
Jason Jakubowski, Hospital for Special Care.
Mary Lou Oleski, International Festival of Arts and Ideas.
Judy Goldfarb, Citizen.
Sally Reese, Citizen also.
Judy Simon, Head of the Connecticut Conference of Independent Colleges.
Mike Argano, the Connecticut State College and University System.
Indeed. With that, I wonder if I can have a motion to approve last month's meetings, please. Zago, so moved. Second? Judy? All in favor? Any opposed? So moved and passed. So we keep slogging. We're making progress on our strategic plan. And I think our goals, we're still on target. And hopefully today, our goal is really to engage in some real, hopefully, substantive conversation. And let me frame it for you, because I think there's been overall, and I feel like I've said it 5,000 times, I think nobody disagrees with the actual goals themselves, our three goals for our strategic plan. But based on lots of conversations that we've had around with individuals and groups of people, there are things that really need to change if we're going to make those goals come true. And there are things we need to talk about, because we can't really flesh this plan out until we have both identified what those things are and perhaps begun to strategize about how we meet and how we address some of those issues. So that's really where we are going today. The discussion will help really, I think, put the last piece of flesh on the plan. And hopefully by November, which will be after the election, we will have an opportunity to have something which can, in fact, be useful to whomever is sitting in the governor's office and the Office of Policy and Management. And Ben, no disrespect given. it's a crapshoot. I mean, it's
me too.
And for all of us. So I think that, you know, hopefully. What'd you say? It depends what game you're playing, right? in any case, so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ames. I think Ames and I've had a lot of discussion with many of you as well, too, about some of those things that we're going to get us started to. So let me turn it over to Ames, please.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to make some introductory comments, but as Judy emphasized, I think the most useful part of this meeting, I'm thinking about the feedback. The most useful part of this meeting will be here, and maybe there are two comments. I'm just amazed that for the amount of time we've worked on this thing, that you all are good soldiers to come and work on this. The second thing is, I think it's really difficult, at least I'm putting myself in your position, particularly of those of you who have official positions at one place or another, to speak out on some of these issues. So I want to give you the benefit of the doubt, the fact that we have, the rest of you, we've had really good conversations with, particularly with Mike and Sally and Judy, about some of the issues. So if they're unable to, if they don't raise them, I'll try to indirectly raise the issues so that their issues are on the table. Because some of them I think are really difficult. And ultimately we've got to get the ownership of the major institutional sectors in this process. So listening to them is really important. It's just off, and if you're in a public session, it's kind of hard to work through some of those issues. So what I'd like to do is just maybe begin by a summary what I think the outcomes of this meeting could be really useful. We had a discussion of, I'm going to go back over the goals just briefly. But if you look at the, if you say what should be the major objectives of this plan, they're essentially the elements of the things that must change in order to achieve the goal, overall goals. So what I'd really like you to talk about are the major barriers or things that must change in order to get to the goals, because they really will frame the nature of the objectives that we're talking about. The other point I just want to stress is that, and I'll mention this in a slide, because I'll do a couple of introductory slides maybe to get the conversation going. If I go back over our regional meetings and meetings with stakeholders and discussions here, a lot of the critical issues are not necessarily at the state colleges and universities specifically within the jurisdiction of the Board of Regents, or issues that are explicitly within the role of the Board of Trustees of UConn, or within the role of the independent sector. But they're issues that really fall between, and they're between and among the sectors, and issues that that no one sector could deal with alone. The most fundamental issue is setting goals for the state as a whole that pull all sectors together to which everything relates. A second issue is the metrics that relate to every sector. A third issue is, in fact, the data systems necessary to have a way to measure progress related to those. But there are a whole set of issues related to the preparation of youth and adults to get into the system that are beyond the jurisdiction of any particular sector. There are a whole set of issues that I'll just put X, Y, and Z that we could put on the table that actually require collaboration across the sectors. And I think we'll make most progress by, in fact, highlighting the things that really we must do together that cut across these sectors and try to stress those kinds of issues. Now, the most fundamental question is the system sustainable, and is it really affordable to students? So I think a major part of this is, how is the system going to be financed? What's the share of the responsibility of the state and students, and how is that going to be put together? And that is way beyond any one of our individual sectors. So those are just some of the issues, but if you turn around the questions, the points that I just mentioned, they can be key priorities, key objectives in the plan, and then frame the kinds of issues that I've talked about. I just make just one other observation. It seems to Dennis and me that many of the issues that are critical to meeting the first goal are, in fact, the issues that get wiped out in the budget process simply because they're discretionary items, whether related to funding necessary to meet the goals of NextGen in terms of numbers of students, whether there are issues related to funding of developmental ed, funding of the students who are in the transition category, in other words, the students who can't even meet the grade of getting in developmental ed. Those are the issues that are really handled as items, and they're overwhelmingly in this state funded on a one-time and pilot basis. So if you say that one of the things we're really concerned about is a strategy to deal with the populations we talked about, there have to be, in fact, sustainable finance policies that are affordable for the state and affordable for students. I just mentioned that. So What I'd like to do is just make a couple of brief things, but maybe see that we can get a good conversation going about what you feel are the major things that must change in order for us to be able to reach the goals that we're talking about. And I have a couple of the ones, again, that people have mentioned who may not be, I'll be a surrogate mentioner of some issues that people are concerned about because they, you know, there may be a lack of willingness to, no, not a lack of willingness and uncertainty about putting them out on the table. Is that okay? So I think we can come out, maybe what I'm telling you is that I'm not starting with the draft that's before you. I'm saying we're going to develop a draft right now. Maybe one other final point. You didn't hear me mentioning anything about a word that began with E. What would you guess is that word that begins with E? No. Oh, gosh. I didn't say anything about an entity, okay? We're not starting with that. I think we've about dug that beast to death and beaten it around. We can talk about that later on, but I want to get really at, that's not what we're really about. So what the goals are and what the objectives are. And I just want to start by, I'm not going to use all these things, but these are the goals that we talked about. Education attainment, globally competitive economy and sustainable regions and communities and affordability. And we had a discussion at the last meeting of elaborating on affordability, which relates to affordability for students and also for taxpayers. And there's a sustainability issue in that. We talked about targets. I think we had less discussion of these, but I frankly think these are really frame some of the real challenges, and I think if we can get some help from you about if we're going to get to the overall goals, progress has to be made on these issues. And frankly, I think these are part of the issues that do fall between any one of the sectors. They're things that I don't think anybody can deal with solely by one institution or another. Sort of connections with K-12 and adult ed. There is, if I just talk about other states, what you'll find is that states with very decentralized K-12 systems, like Connecticut, with a strong tradition of local control, it's likely to be higher ed that is likely to be the only means to have some statewide statement about what it means to be college and career readiness, because there simply will not be consensus, a way to develop consensus in K-12 about what that's about. That can be much easier, more done through higher education systems in collaboration with business and civic leaders rather than necessarily getting consensus within the K-12 system. There's a lot of, I didn't put a dot by the issue related to need for remediation, but that's part of it. The education attainment gaps, again, are major problems that cut across all sectors and all levels of education. The adult issue is, as summarized by you all and in our regional meetings, the adults who essentially, in my own words, get lost in essentially workforce development programs that have no affordable bridge to getting into degree-granting or credit-bearing courses. The affordability for those students is an incredible barrier, and how you really deal with the bridge between higher education and adult ed for those students is a major challenge. And then, again, related to that is sort of the urban core issue. You simply can't get to these goals without making progress with that population, and again, it's a question of whether that's attainable. So, as we said, the core recommendation of the plan would those goals be adapted, and that they really serve as a basis for making clear a framework. And I had carefully drawn pictures on this framework, and what I had there, and you were to imagine this. If you think of three boxes across there, overall goals, but the three boxes are really the goals for UConn, which I think, Sally, is what creating our future. And then for CSCU is Transform 2020. And then the goals of the various independent institutions across the diversity of that sector. The point I want to mention for mentioning that is that, and Sally, I did a Paston activity, but I'm basically from your academic plan, but this is sort of an aspiration of UConn with goals and, you know, really good text around each one of those subparts. What I want to emphasize is those are really important but fundamentally different from the education attainment goals. But every one is, in fact, moving towards the overall goals. So what I really want to emphasize is that if somebody looks at what the Planning Commission comes up with, they should immediately see how it reinforces what UConn wants to do on each one of those issues. The public engagement, for example, is very much connected with the goal number two. But every single one of those, in fact, bears some relationship to that. And the same thing with, and Mike, I may not have been right with these, but they look good anyway, don't you think? I took them from an earlier report, but they all relate to these points, and Mike did a really good alignment. Again, that is what I want to stress is that these are things that the institutions are already doing, making progress on, that relate to the overall goals. And from a public and legislative point of view, people have to see how all these fit together. And Judy, I don't have them for all your institutions, but you wouldn't mind, but I mean, I could make them up. But I mean, each one across all those institutions have, you know, goals that relate to this. Now, if this plan really is going to be a success, a legislator ought to be able to see the goals and recognize that the connection of each of the sectors in a differentiated way, how you're all contributing to this. And the overall accountability ought to have some relationship to those goals. In other words, that UConn, and I maybe just relate to this, Sally, you have a goal in next gen of enrolling X number of students. That's a key element that we build in the plan for doing it. You're saying if we are not getting funded to do that, who's going to pay for it? Is it students? Is out-of-state students? How is that going to be done? So that's why how the framework is kind of working. Let's see. That was more stuff related to Transform. Couple of you, I know John Bennett. Pardon me? Yeah, I know, but he's kind of here in spirit. He's, or at least by 40 million emails. I think there's a lot of concerns. I just want to share some points of view. We constantly face this issue, and I think it's important, at least we found, when I say we, I blame it all on Dennis, but that there are really different views about this, and I maybe as a sub-point, there's a really good, I think, a really good website put together by the American Council on Education about different ways of looking at about how all the changes are taking back. I think a lot of the focus has been on the challenge of unbundling faculty role, dividing the roles of content development, content delivery, and a set of other issues. And a lot of the feedback from sort of the blog connected with that has been a visceral and negative reaction to use of the word customer or client by faculty groups. So let me just express the sensitivity to that point of view. So if anybody's looking and watching and saying, boy, this group is totally insensitive to that point, I understand. But The point of those couple of things is that people ask fundamentally different questions and define quality differently. And from a legislative point of view, people are really concerned about issues, the sort of impact of the on the state. And these are the kinds of issues they constantly will raise, at least in my experience of working with legislators, not necessarily Roberta, but others, you know, over and over again, of sort of how the pieces fit together and connect with the needs of the state. If you look at sort of business and corporate leaders, their definition of quality tends to be around these issues, how you really apply, how you really develop problem-solving skills, sort of outcomes like that. If you look at institutional, you know, characteristics, they're tend to be around issues of student-centered, good undergraduate practices, clarity of mission, issues like that, that are fundamentally different from kind of workforce things. And I just to pursue that a little bit more, if you look at what parents are looking for, it's not necessarily the same thing that people internally within an institution. They may be looking related to their nature, their experiences, the nature and access to services. One of the problems you run into, and each of you who have worked with faculty senate, with student senate and student leaders, there's a great strong interest in these issues and in affordability, but it's often difficult to get an understanding of the issues from a faculty perspective related to quality. So I just, I want to help us, and maybe we can end the conversation. I think that issues of quality are really important, but what do we really mean by that? And how do we make sure that the people who have different perspectives understand why that particular perspective is important? The only way I can work with this is to say all of these points of view are legitimate. The issue is then how do you develop a balance among them so that one point of view doesn't drive out the other. So I hope that's helpful, but we can talk about that in the discussion. Now, I just want to, and what I'm going to say now, I think if you can just describe this as not about Connecticut, but it will be so obvious I'm talking about a parable here. But it's framed from the fact that I grew up and started my career in Maine, and I'm now deeply involved with Nancy Zimpher and SUNY with 64 campuses, and I just spent this last week trying to help Ireland on working with the university presidents in Ireland on a theme of sustainability of higher education in Ireland, which is basically a population of 4 million. So this is what and Dennis Jones, incidentally, has written an article in the current edition of Change magazine on this same issue. What you do is you get pretty good broad consensus among people about the importance of these kinds of goals we're talking about. That basically an educated population, again with the depth of knowledge and skills that John Bennett and others have emphasized, is absolutely critical to the future of the country. But they're also important for the individuals, that in fact, unless your graduates have the depth of understanding and knowledge and skills which a good undergraduate experience will bring, they simply will not be able to be employed or have the mobility that they'll need. In fact, they'll be stuck in a significant way in which they might have a job one time, but they won't have a job a second time. There'll be no way to really get through the thing. So it's these things are really important, and so you can get broad consensus about that. The reality is just absolutely as stark as you can imagine of whether, in fact, there are the resources available. I could give you the same litany in every state, but I'm thinking particularly of Maine and Ireland in this case. Most of their resources in any time, first of all, they're dealing with economic crisis. In fact, in the case of Ireland, it was a question of just simply going bankrupt, is tied up in basically unfunded pensions, incredibly high and unfunded health costs, and unsustainable capacity in the whole system. That it, in other words, when the budget director in the case of Ireland, the Minister of Finance faces a budget. There's virtually, he's also dealing with extreme external pressures to deal with indebtedness, not only of the state, but of individuals, which is extraordinary. And but also the fact that the students, if you look at the Portland Press Herald in Maine this last weekend, the headline was essentially unaffordability of the system and a discussion about the incomes of population in Maine compared to the cost of the University of Maine and going to independent higher ed. So the picture is overwhelming that there, and it isn't that there isn't any new money, but whatever money is allocated is going to have to be allocated on a strategic basis. In other words, that the business is not. So if I pick on either Maine or Ireland, Ireland has seven universities and a whole technical college system. Maine has seven universities and a community college system. In the case of Maine, and you've all been reading about this in the paper, there is no way that is simple out of that situation. They're going to have to maintain regional presence of universities in every part of that state. But having a full-service institution is simply unsustainable. They're trying to have a major research university, but the University of Maine is, in fact, competing for the very same students that UConn is competing for and the University of Rhode Island is competing for. And they have a few very strong independent institutions, but the other institutions are competing for exactly the same students. If you go to Nancy Zimfer's case, she has 64 campuses. The community colleges, 30 of them, are all embedded in county government with extreme economic pressures on those counties. And the counties are unable to increase funding. The cost of higher education in that state of community college level has been shifted overwhelmingly to students. And the state funding has basically not increased, period. So she's looking across a whole system and saying, for heaven's sakes, we are simply cannot support everything, but what do we really need to be really good? How do we really focus our resources so we can have a competitive research university and the kind of and meet the goals which she really feels are extremely important for the future of New York? Now, every single one of these systems has a set of constraints that make it extremely difficult to do anything. 85% of everything that goes on in higher ed is people. I mean, faculty members are the heart of what goes on within an institution. So what faculty members do and how they're motivated and the quality of their life makes a huge difference of whether you're able to meet your goals. You just don't do it. There's a lot of discussion about sort of online and a whole series of modes of technology, but ultimately, this needs to be a place that attracts the extremely bright people who need to have an environment that really supports and what they're doing. And the truth is that it's very difficult to do it that way. And as any of you know, because if you run institutions, dealing with how you people are used, and that can be even that use and that word in itself can be really pejorative in context, is extremely important. And if you take that off the table, but the reality of the matter is, in most of these states, there are virtually no degrees of freedom. Ireland has a nationwide labor agreement that basically says that you cannot move faculty members from one position to another without agreement within the framework of the Croke Park Agreement. University of Maine has exactly the same things, plus all the aftermath of relatively clumsy efforts, which I think the University of Maine, because I'm always saying if I'm going to say something, it will be listened to. But I think that over the years, the relationships with the unions have really aggravated things rather than helped sort of the collaborative environment. So, and then you basically have a policy misalignment. So that if you're at an institutional level, I mean, and dealing with these issues, and people say, oh, well, go do this and go do that. And you've got to say, excuse me, with what and under what circumstances? And are you, in fact, as a state, helping me make some excruciatingly difficult choices? In the case of Maine, probably four or five institutions in 5 years from now will not be full-service institutions. But there are faculty members and families and regions that are all tied up in that, and they have to manage that process of change. And you'll read in the newspapers the consequences and the dangers the difficulty of doing that. So I just want to stress this in terms of barriers, because some of you may not be able to say this, but I just, from Dennis's point of view and mine, it's important for the Planning Commission to realize it. What's happening, this is a picture that Dennis put together of when you put together an institutional budget, what do you focus on? What is happening in the country is that most institutional leaders, and I think it's fair to say that in a way, are focusing overwhelmingly on the right-hand side of this picture. They're trying to find every possible way to get a revenue-generating student, where in fact the net tuition will in fact help support that, because in fact the getting of many students requires offset with institutional student financial aid. And they're trying to, every device through online learning and other ways, basically to increase revenue sources. And in a region like this, you'll find ever overwhelming pressure to recruit out-of-state students, because, in fact, you can get a premium on that. But if you realize that, in fact, Nancy Zimfer's major goal is to fill the places in SUNY, the major goal of Rhode Island is to fill every place in Rhode Island, and in Massachusetts to fill every place in Massachusetts, with out-of-state students, where are the out-of-state students coming from, and who's going to be, and that the real issue, in fact, in many states, will in fact, what you can do is deal with the students who are in Judy Grimond's institutions, because you can probably, you know, make a benefit on price, so it has a major impact on the income. The other thing is sort of imagining that you can make up the loss in state funding simply by marketing or a fundraising effort. So the truth is, yeah, you ought to be doing that. But ultimately, the issue comes down to the left-hand side. And the decisions Dennis and I have put up on that picture, that things that where are decisions made, decisions about personnel in higher ed are overwhelmingly made at a department and college level within the framework of a university framework. It's made at one faculty member at a time, department at a time, in a very difficult process, and they're also really difficult, particularly if you are in the framework of a collective bargaining or statewide agreements. So when we talk about dealing with achieving the goals in this situation, I don't think I'm imagining something that Connecticut has a similar kind of issue. I mean, if you face, you know, a deficit of a billion and a half plus unfunded, you know, liabilities of one sort or another, issues related to bonding, whoever's making the choices has to make some really difficult issues. And the point we've been trying to stress is get the goals up there so that people really know how important the goals are for the state. Understand how the plans of each of these systems are linked to those goals, and they're trying to achieve those things, but recognize that there need to be policy changes in order for that to be able to go about. You can't just say to them, go off and do these things, because frankly, the degrees of freedom to do that vary all the way across the system. The other point is that ultimately, I think one of the benefits that Connecticut has is that most of the public sector is under the jurisdiction of two boards that have the range of freedom to make some of these decisions. Because they will have to, in contrast to Maine, where what's happening in Maine, the community college system is in fact underpricing the University of Maine and essentially cratering the University of Southern Maine, because all the students go to the community college at a discounted price, and therefore there are no undergraduates at University of Southern Maine. And therefore, they can't support their upper division courses. So seeing these things as a piece and recognizing that in order to sustain what you're doing now, in most places means you're eating each other's children. You're simply transferring enrollment from one place to another place. You're not really making progress on the basic goals up here. Because the really difficult students are not the ones that are currently enrolled. They're ones that are not enrolled. So with that in mind, I hate to do great lectures about the things, but the summary of the thing is the goals are overarching. There are good things going on. The fiscal and policy environment is really fundamental to changes in that are fundamental to being able to get to the goals. And the hope of this kind of commission is to present to the governor and the legislature the fact that higher education is fundamental to the future of Connecticut and its citizens. But there's got to be a way to figure out how the place is going to be financed, either by state or students, and those are going to be the principal sources. So with that, what are the four or five things that must change in order to get to these goals? And having taken up all your time, let me just listen to you and be as open. And if you're dead silent and are looking down at the floor, I'll realize that you maybe don't want to say anything. Mike.
Let me offer a comment or two as a practitioner and as someone who is new to Connecticut. I think in many ways we're pretending. We're pretending in the sense that if we just grow our enrollments, everything's going to be fine. If we create a new tax base in Connecticut, everything's going to be fine. If we do other sorts of things to generate more revenue at the campus level, everything is going to be fine. And I'm not convinced that is true. What I'm becoming more and more convinced is that the model we have relative to the funding structure is not sustainable for post-secondary education. Not sustainable in the sense that it will not allow the institutions to achieve their aspirations. And so I think part of this conversation is really to think in terms of what some other states have done that I'm probably a little bit more familiar with, that look at education as a shared responsibility. That states that seem to view education as shared responsibility see it as a real value and benefit to the state to have an educated citizenry. And likewise, the individual, the citizen, sees it as a real personal benefit to have an education. And so in that sort of context is how do we share in that cost of education? What should be the responsibility of the state and what is the responsibility of the individual if you accept that they both have equal benefit? So our friends to the north in Massachusetts in the university system have moved towards a model of which it's 50-50. The state contributes 50 and the individual contributes 50. And the individual contribution is more focused on what we all know as being the educational cost, tuition fees, mandatory fees, and books. And they separate student lifestyle, which is the residence halls, the dining commons, and all those other sorts of things, and say that, okay, that is your sort of preference to have that sort of lifestyle, and you have an obligation with that. And so if we continue with this model or this concept of acknowledging two different shared responsibilities, then the next piece of this equation is what should be the statewide financial aid strategy. Right, the statewide financial aid strategy for that student, and when I talk about a student, I am referencing full-time, part-time, non-traditional adult learners, the whole definition that you can possibly come up with here. And that starts to change the landscape a little bit. All right. The other thing that I think is critical here is you rightfully point out that we're all eating each other's lunch. Right? We're in this belief that if we just grow our enrollment, everything is going to be fine, and so we'll go to Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and we'll go to all these other states. And when I go to New Jersey, I run into Judith, who's there, right, recruiting for
12, 15 different private universities. I go to Long Island and I run into Sally and the other 18 private universities on Long Island and say, what are you doing here? She says, I was here yesterday. You just came today. It's too late. I already got them all. Okay. And then we say, well, we'll do something internationally. We'll just get some more international students. But in the meantime, MIT and Harvard and Cal Berkeley and Michigan and everybody else already beat us overseas. Right? And so what we have is a diminishing market. And there's no indication that the traditional market is going to change all that much, but we have some indication that the adult retraining market probably has some growth with that as well, all right? Which then requires us to rethink of our menu of various academic programs and how they relate to those various regions that we serve. The other thing that I think is worthy of a conversation, the best that I can tell, is that in the Connecticut model, we reward you for enrollment and continuous enrollment. Meaning, you enroll Gargano, and the longer you can keep Gargano enrolled, you keep getting rewarded by the state. And I think the conversation should change that acknowledges enrollment, but I think the greatest reward should be in retention, progression, and degree completion. Because if, in fact, we are going to achieve any of these goals that are worthy goals to achieve, we have to change the culture and the funding mechanism to reward what it is that we want the institutions to produce. So if you wanted to produce more scientists, you would reward us for more scientists, right? We're creatures of habit. We will do exactly what you tell us to do. And you've told us decades ago that we're going to reward you for enrollment. And yeah, you should continue to do that, but I'm advocating that you tell us now that you're going to reward us for outputs as well. So I offer that for commentary. I offer that as a practitioner. I offer it for discussion. But that's my observation after a few months.
So now, Mike, if you you don't have to do it right now, but the moral of the story is whatever objectives we have to have, we come out of this, basically need to pick up one or two of the themes that you just emphasized. In other words, a financing plan that reflects shared responsibility and, you know, a financing plan that rewards the institutions for making progress towards the goals. And again, probably the goals, I think you probably agree the goals need to be population-specific and mission-specific, so they'll be very different for community college or one of the state universities, for UConn, and again, there's diversity across the independent sector.
I would agree with that, and I think part of this conversation is you put up a slide up there that identified that 85% in most cases of our revenue is tied up into personnel one way or another, right? And that's very true. And no one likes talking about this. If we are going to think in terms of recalibration, we have to talk about it. And we have to talk about it in a very honest way with our colleagues all at the table to say that if we want to make or create a different model, then that has to be part of this conversation. And I think the other part of this is, do we have this discussion or and follow through amongst this group, or are there other groups that have to play a key role with it? Right? Where do we take this conversation? Does it go to, do we have it within our own means to create the type of change that we might all advocate for? Or do we have to find a different venue to create the type of change that we're advocating for?
Yeah, in some ways, I'm thinking of a way not to draw people into the conversation who actually have responsibility for dealing with this issue, okay? But what's happening all over the place is that because of dealing with the difficulty of dealing with that issue, and I was frankly, Mike, I think the issue is I'm not sure people really know how to, and I'll give you some examples of that, is there's a lot of emphasis on using modes of delivery and everything that kind of dodge that question altogether. For example, Charter Oak is really an important way to serve this population, and that's a new mode of delivery. But you have institutions and campuses with real-life, very helpful, important faculty resources all over the state. And how do you engage those faculty in coming up with a solution, rather than simply saying, oh, well, we're just going to go around that? Now, if you look at systems around the country, very few are really finding a way to deal with that. For example, Nancy Zimfer is really concerned about how to create communities across SUNY of faculty members to, in fact, grapple with that issue, rather than coming up with simply administrator system designs that presume that they'll be great. She's using the Faculty Senate for that purpose and other kinds of ways to have a conversation, rather than coming at the faculty directly in a way that just doesn't engage them. But not very many systems are, in fact, finding ways, communities, to deal with that. And with what I define as how to have engage faculty in really rethinking the faculty role, there's a very good article in Inside Higher Ed by a person named Phil Altbach from Boston College, who's an international authority on the academic profession. And his fundamental concern is most of the reforms being funded by Gates and everything are essentially not putting the issue that you just described on the table and finding a constructive way to deal with the issue of the future role of faculty. So I just put that on the table because I think you're absolutely right. If you just simply ignore it, it's going to come out in other ways.
I will just share one other thing. I mean, one of the recommendations might be that we create a faculty innovation fund. And maybe we need about $100,000 to start, and maybe you can get a grant for another $100,000. But I could see something of which we have faculty at UConn, faculty at our private institutions, and faculty in the Connecticut State College and University system come together. And perhaps we have to buy out their time for a year, and they really spend serious time and research and effort to rethink curriculum, rethink teaching methods, rethink student learning outcomes, rethink consortiums that we might create around the state of Connecticut, rethink collaboratives that we might be able to create around the state of Connecticut, and where the faculty lead this part of this enterprise, mm-hmm. and present a variety of recommendations to you all so that what we end up with is something that is rooted both in practical experience and technical experience and the expertise of our renowned faculty. I mean, we might be surprised what faculty might design as the new classroom and the new learning environment and the new collaboratives.
Yes.
I think part of the recalibration of the process that Mike Gargano is talking about is the issue getting away from a funding model and focusing on spending model, and the issue of how you are able to graduate more students given the how expensive it has become. The particular issue is the uneven and unequal distribution of funds within every campus between student services and academics. I mean, this has become a major concern. The numbers, the average numbers are as follows: about 25% increase in student services over the last 10 years really, versus 5.5% in academics. So the idea of assisting faculty to do all the good things, it means that we have to focus on faculty, what they do and what it takes to do it, and student services are just going through the roof. And that conversation, I think, has to take place at some point, and how we do that, I am not sure. given that every institution is committed to its own mission and every institution thinks they know how to accomplish their mission, well, how are we going to get together and become a team? And I agree with your comments, it will take a team basically to reach those goals. How we're going to do that if there is so much difference and variety in institutional missions vis-a-vis the state? Actually, I wonder if I say that, but I wonder if Sally Reese can give me a candid opinion about that. I'm thinking particularly about the University of Connecticut. We are thinking about generating a team of institutions here, but then if the University of Connecticut gets the funding, the lion's share of the funding that I think they do, why would the University of Connecticut be interested in participating in teamwork to achieve those goals? Sally, can you talk just about this?
I want to just correct one thing, and then I'd be glad to comment. You know, we very carefully look at our cross-admits. So if you would make the point that we are sharing admits with UMass, that's accurate. But for the last fall, our cross-admits are most frequently with Northeastern, BU, Delaware, Penn State, Maryland, Drexel, BC, and Fordham. The only cross-admit in the state of Connecticut in terms of our top 20 is Quinnipiac. So it goes back again to mission. We're not competing with the Board of Regents for admits anymore. We did, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, but our pool is different now. And again, we share cross-admits with Quinnipiac. Happy to send you the data on this, any of you. And I think that what that says to us is that UConn is better as an institution when the Board of Regents is able to do better as an institution. And we, our president has said, our provost that I have said consistently, we would want to do everything we can to support the Board of Regents and to help in any way we can to have them do better. Their success is important to the state. We, however, as I said last time, feel like we've lived up to the promises made to Connecticut with our retention, our graduation, our increased enrollment in STEM, and even our opportunities to try to raise more money through private endowment. So,
Sally, let me just interrupt that a second.
Yeah.
I just reflecting a conversation I had with an NCSL.
Mm-hmm.
You know what the number one interest was?
Mm-mm.
Berkeley's announcement that it made $250 million by admitting students from everywhere other than California.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the interest of legislators in California for essentially penalizing that institution for doing that.
Well, we walk a fine line. Ben can sit here and tell you
Let me pursue it. What if the state of Connecticut
mm-hmm.
said, we do not have any money, in fact, probably negative, to fund the students that are essential? You list in your plan the number one challenge is getting funding,
mm-hmm.
okay? We cannot fund the additional enrollment with NextGen.
Mm-hmm.
Where does the money come from to finance those students? It has to come, I'm making this up, but you can say which one is probably wrong. It has to come through generating more paying students
mm-hmm.
from non-Connecticut sources.
Okay.
And
well,
probably from private fundraising, or else by not admitting the students.
That's correct.
In other words, limiting enrollment.
So it would be
the consequence, therefore, mm-hmm. is increasingly going to draw you away to get students from exactly the list that you just did,
mm-hmm.
which is, in fact, not serving Connecticut, okay? And that, in my experience, and I could give you 20 examples, is exactly what generates the anger of legislators that you have a major research university here, but it's not serving Connecticut.
Well, correct. And we currently
isn't that a
know,
possibility?
Yes. We currently know that 70 to 80% of the students, depending on the year you do the analysis, who graduate stay in the state. So if we're bringing in out-of-state students, they may
but
stay.
But you know that you can sell that only marginally, especially when you look at evidence. We heard in every single,
mm-hmm.
Interview we made the concern about losing students.
But that's not database. The database argument that I'm making to you is that in the research that we do of our students who stay in the state, those who attend UConn from out of state, we're getting a large percentage of those students to stay. That's one argument, but I agree with your premise. The premise is that if we don't get the money from the state, then if we have to, do we look at a higher percentage? Right now, this year, we had about 61% of the students who were accepted as freshmen from in-state and 39% from out-of-state. Now, overall, we're still at an 80-20 mix because many out-of-state students are transferring back into UConn after they go to Miami University of Ohio for a year and realize their education at UConn would have been just as good. So we still are at 80-20. But if we look at more out-of-state admissions, then obviously legislators, including some that you all know, you know, call us to task and say you need to be taking more state students. So, not Roberto. So, yeah, I mean, these are the concerns. But the point I want to make is we share the concern for helping and working with the board to be the best they can do and to do anything we can to support the Board of Regents. And we also share the concern that there's with Ben and the rest of people that worry about the state budget, including us, that there's not enough money to go around.
So let me make a commercial about connection of UConn with the goals.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me this is a really good way, isn't it not, to make a point that UConn Next Gen figures are part of the strategy to meet those goals.
Yeah, I mean.
Right. So in other words, so that if they're unable to meet those goals, it's part of the plan. So this is, in fact, a framework for that.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that I think, just to reinforce your point, I think the evidence around the country that it is not going to be the UConns that face the sustainability issue. The real issue is going to be, as you mentioned, it's going to be a real issue and challenge for the CSCU sector. And because they serve, so the sustain.
We have different missions.
But you have much more diverse sources of revenue.
Correct.
You know, I use the example in Ireland of Berkeley, which has $55,000 per student,
mm-hmm.
of which only 9% is from the state, whereas the comparable CSCU institution has $13,000 from the state. From the total, most of which comes from the state.
Mm-hmm.
So if the state funding is going down, and also the state colleges and universities, as you point out, have to recruit from a local market, and they're much more sensitive to affordability of the state's population. Mm-hmm. So I think your point, I think it's important, and I think probably Judy could give a rendition of probably A to Z of variations across your sector of the same kind of challenge. Okay, so if I could just, I think this is, yeah, excuse me. Yes, sir. Three or four. So that's
well,
right.
I have two points I'd like to make. One is, I'm going to go back to that comment that Mike made before about the shared responsibility. And you, right before you said that the state and the students need to figure out how they're going to share responsibility. You said that in stating the problem, you said there aren't enough resources for institutions, so and as a result, the institutions cannot fulfill their aspirations. I think that's a direct quote. The institutions cannot fulfill their aspirations. Therefore, not the institutions, but the students and the state need to figure out how to share responsibility so that the institutions, presumably, can fulfill their aspirations. I understand that there is implied here a nexus that somehow when the institutions fulfill their aspirations, the state and the students are enriched. And I know that that generally is true, but I'm not sure that it's a direct line. That's not a straight line in my mind. There may be things that the institutions wish to do which have no benefit to the state or to the students or which do not benefit some of our goals. So I just want to point out that while I understand that we all need to figure out, you know, how much, you know, how we're going to pay for this whole thing and what we're going to do, I really think that we need to keep it in mind. There are three parts. And you really came back to that when you talked about the need to look at how faculty are deployed, which is obviously the central mm-hmm. question for how institutions are involved. But I just want to make that point, that there are three legs to this stool in my mind.
If Dennis was here, he would be reinforcing that.
Well, you know. I've done it for him in the absence. The second point I'd like to make is that I think that this, you know, I'm thinking about these goals, and, you know, you said in your remarks that, you know, the goals are widely agreed to. Everybody, these are good things.
I'm
mom and apple pie. I mean, who doesn't want this? And yet, that first goal, which really is an overarching one, I mean, I think about that, it doesn't get us anywhere. It's vague. It doesn't really help us much. Because, I mean, in the case of UConn, then this suggests that they shouldn't be bringing in out-of-state students unless they have very strong abilities to retain those students here in Connecticut, meaning they have to, you know, the only way that you could support under that goal, as the paramount goal, is a very strong strategy for job placement in state, you know, retention strategies, getting people to uproot their lives and making Connecticut their home. And frankly, among CSCU, it would tell you to abandon bringing in and trying to get degrees to the hardest to reach students. Those are going to be the most expensive and difficult to educate and get to your goal. You should be going out and looking for adults. You should be doing the sort of go back to get ahead model, which, you know, I didn't think of it in this context, but you take adults who already have set down roots, who are already committed to living in Connecticut, have families here and lives here, and getting them college degrees. That would be the quickest way to increase the percentage to 70%. And going and taking people who have a high likelihood of dropping out and not being successful in their higher education and making them be better educated is the longest way to get to that and is the least direct approach. And yet, we really do believe that we should be embarking on remedial education. I believe that deeply. And yet, it is not supported by this primary goal. This primary goal says I should be doing something different. And I think that UConn firmly believes, and I'm not sure I do, but I accept that they do, and I might be convinced that they need to have these heavily resourced programs that require out-of-state students and revenues in order to support them in their success, and that the state is enriched. That may be true too. That's not in compliance with this goal. So this goal really does seem to suggest that a whole bunch of things that everybody wants to do and everybody is pursuing don't make any sense. So I call question whether that should be the first goal.
This is really great. What you've just been saying is a good example of why this may be written in a way that doesn't communicate. Because the truth is that, let me just go back to one point. The ultimate measure is whether the education attainment of people in the given catchment area is moving from being relatively uneducated to having more post-secondary credentials from certificate and above, okay? Where this may communicate that the source of improvement on that is only by the graduation of people from the institutions in the state. One of the realities is, and I just reinforce a point that Sally made that I sort of tried to say was not the case, is that one of the most powerful effects of getting out-of-state students and the effects of institutions, public and private in this state, is in fact they are the magnets that in fact draw an educated population of the state. So you've got to look at not only the people being produced, but also the effect of migration. And so it isn't just the students being produced. If you look at any of the models that we presented to you, there's an assumption of in-migration. So in some ways, the investment in next-gen related to research is a key way of doing that, and goal number two is a key way of achieving the first goal. The other thing, Ben, is I can't, unless you deal with the issues of that we've listed on the indicators, you know, the urban core problem, the adults not getting through, aren't those essential to dealing with improving the education attainment of the state? I mean,
I guess, but you know, I first of all, I'm not certain that the effectiveness at degree production of our higher education institutions is as effective a way to move the number that 70% get to 70% as our ability to attract international immigrants. I mean, 1/3 of Stanford's population moved into Stanford from out of the country between 2000 and 2010. And they were largely highly educated folks attracted by jobs in the financial services sector. They probably, significant percentage of them had college educations, maybe 70%, I don't know. I mean, that's a lot of people. That's a graduating class that's close to the number of you know, graduates that are produced by a medium-sized college in a decade.
So Connecticut has done really well on two kinds of things: importing well-educated people for that purpose, and importing large numbers of very poorly educated people. I think you're absolutely right. Just to pick on another issue related, which is relevant to Connecticut, if you look at Bar Harbor, Maine, and that region of Maine, which is desperately poor, what do you think the number one variable has been to improve the education attainment of that region?
Probably economic development. I mean, individual companies arriving.
No, it's been Jackson Labs.
They're
the ones who have hired more people in Bar Harbor than have been hired just this last year. They're their only source of new employment. So in some respects, your investment in the other parts of NextGen, everything like that, have a major impact on actually achieving goal number one.
No, in our housing strategy, and I buy it. I guess my argument is that the way it's written here, it seems as though if we just can push more people through the pipe, that we're going to raise the number to 70% and we can declare victory. And I think it's far more complex than that. I mean, I understand the point about the interrelationship with economic development, but we also have other things. I mean, housing policy is enormously impactful
and
to
tax
whether
policy.
Or not people can stay in Connecticut after they leave. You know, affordability is a big issue. Tax policy, economic development policy, all these things have a huge impact. And I'd like to see this as a
member of this great commission. Between now and November 7th, you know, we need to make sure that it reflects that what you're describing.
Ames, I wonder if I could take off a chair's hat and sort of a couple of observations, Ben. You could look at that in a strict constructionist way, that first goal. But I think it's if you do some of the deeper dives that NGEMS did for us in terms of the demographics, the real opportunity for increasing enrollment and retention and graduation or attainment is that adult. We don't have enough. There was a very interesting mathematical analysis that NGEMS did that shows if you did all of the things that we know right about urban education and reducing the achievement gap, you still can't come close to what we need in terms of an educated population without the adult population, the 25 to 64-year-old. And that is the opportunity that's here already. And some of them are immigrants, but some of them need remediation. And I, from personal experience, I can tell you a lot of those that are out there need that remediation piece. So it's not quite, to me, it's not quite as cut and dried as that.
But just to underscore what Judy says, if you look at the model we did, and thanks, Judy, I think that, Noah, if you look at how you get to a 70% and say what variables really make a difference, you can do it partly by in-migration, and you can do something, but frankly, you are already maxed out on well-prepared students getting through, partly through what Sally's talking about and also the role that the independent sector plays. The things that really will make a difference are actually for a population that is here and place-bound. It is not highly mobile. And that relates to the adult population. That's probably good. But it relates to the adult population, the technician population, the certificate level. If you're really going to move the needle on that, it's probably greater production from CSCU, Mike, across the system, and significant improvements at the certificate level, which we've talked about. It's not necessarily, and so if you take each of those variables, and they're in that model that we talked about on the assumptions, what would make a difference? So anyway, but I hear you're saying that as it's worded right now, it doesn't communicate what I'm just saying to you.
Yeah, and I'm not going to quibble over too much. I certainly understand the nuances. I guess I just feel as though some of those things are worth doing for a whole host of reasons, regardless of what they do for getting us to 70% or whatever percentage. That seems like a great outcome that benefits our state economically and makes us look good on, you know, state-by-state comparisons and things like that. But we should be dealing with the remediation and getting more people in underserved communities into the mainstream of our economy with college educations, because that's the right thing to do. And that's what we believe as a people and as a state, and not necessarily, I hate to peg that as sort of this is how we're getting to our 70% goal, because it's probably not the cheapest or easiest way to get to our 70% goal. I don't want people saying, well, we're doing X, Y, and Z because it gets us to our 70% goal, even if ultimately it may not be what we all hold out as our aspiration for our system. So I'm just a little concerned about having that be, you know, presented as sort of a paramount goal rather than as a goal to increase the level of education. But we may end up doing it in ways that are circuitous because we have other goals.
Can I just sort of take what you're saying and try, because I think it gets at something, even the points that John Bennett has been making. If there's something about the goal is not just a percentage, but it's the kind of population that the state needs, or the education we need for the citizens in terms of preparation for life, for citizenship, for participation. And if you have larger gaps of the population that simply don't have the level of knowledge and skills to do that in a competitive state, I think that's probably, I mean, that's the reason why you invest in that, right? It's a lot more than just getting to the 70%. Is that okay? Yeah, Booker.
It seems to me that one of the ways of getting to the 70% would be something that was mentioned in the report, cooperative education. And I say this because I'm sure there are students who manage to get enough financial aid or aid of some kind to stay in school, but they have other expenses, they have other responsibilities. So one of the ways to help them to stay in school would be to have a cooperative ed experience, which would be something beyond the typical college work study. And then when that student graduates, the student has experience, and because they've worked at local companies, I'm sure that many of them would have opportunities to work for these companies. So we're getting a different mix of people who are in that 70%. It's the 70% with experience to fill the jobs that are the kinds of jobs that are available in the local economy.
Did you have that experience as a teacher in secondary education or in higher ed?
I did a little bit of secondary, and I did some administration in higher education, community college as well as four-year college. So I've had only one experience, though, with cooperative education in a community college, and I know that it's employed in different places around the country. But it just seems to me that with the population who may not have job skills, this is a way to provide them with what they need to move to the next level, as well as provide them with some income to stay in college. There are people who, my most recent experience has been with community colleges, and there are people who have to drop out because they can't...
So they earn and learn kind of...
Yes. So it seems to me that one of the ways to...
I think what you just mentioned has been a theme we've heard pretty consistently. Now the question is whether we're... And it's helpful. That's a theme emphasized, I think, both in Transform 2020 and as well as in the UConn academic plan in terms of student engagement, which is similar to that. I think the real issue is going to be, are there real incentives for that to be more than just pilot projects? For example, one of the major issues that we've been raised is exactly what you're describing. Does student financial aid really take that in consideration and provide incentives for it? And maybe going back to Mike's point, I mean, if you're going to have more emphasis on co-op ed, that's really a curriculum design faculty time issue. Mm-hmm. You know, faculty members need to be engaged in designing programs that integrate work experience within their. So you just don't say we're going to do cooperative education and it's going to come out of the woodwork. Yes, sir.
I'd like to go back to my original point that I started this with, which is, how are we going to pay for it? I mean, it's easy, or I shouldn't say it's easy. We should put all the various variables on the table. And I think you're exactly right that taxes and housing and culture and lifestyle and business and industry and all those other things play into how people view the state and want to stay in the state. But the real question in my mind in front of us is, with all of the competing interests in the state of Connecticut, health care is one, right? The Affordable Health Care Act. I attended a governor's conference meeting on Friday on employment for people with disabilities and heard various stories and the funding that needs. And there's others that we can talk about that needs funding, but there's only so many dollars that are going to go around. And I think it behooves this group to get to what the main event is. And in my mind, the main event is, how do we pay for higher education? What is the responsibility of the individual? And what is it reasonably that we can expect from the state? And when we have an understanding of those two, then all the publics that we serve can plan properly. They will know exactly what tuition and fees are. They'll know exactly what their expectations are. They'll know exactly what the financial aid plan is for the type of learner that I am, and so on and so forth. And then all these other various variables, which are important, but I'm not convinced yet that they're the main event.
Yeah, but let me just
talk. It makes it a little bit easier.
Yeah, let me just talk to you about the main event, though, Mike. If you say, well, we got to figure out how to do it, and I'm going to pick on Maine in a way that if Maine listened to this recording, they would be totally offended. We say, well, okay, we've got to figure out, and it's now costing us basically $10,000 to $15,000 per student to do that. And you multiply that times the number of students, youth, and adults that are going to need to meet the state goals, and it comes out to a figure that is way beyond what either the students or the state can pay for. So the issue the University of Maine Board of Trustees is facing is, what is their responsibility to rethink the way education is being delivered so it's more affordability? So isn't there another party in this? So what is that other party? I mean, isn't that kind of what the Board of Regents does?
Yes.
Right. It's sort of rethinking the way you're going to deliver things. So I think, Ben, were you raising that partly?
Yes.
Yeah, that...
expenses are controlled by the University of Connecticut Board of Trustees, the Board of Regents, the trustees of private colleges and universities, and the revenues are determined in part by the state, in part by the market, in part by, you know, the decisions of individuals. I think that we are going to have to get down to brass tacks on this. I mean, I know from where I sit, it's frustrating sometimes that, you know, the boards, the governing boards of higher institutions of higher education, public institutions, are always, and I'm not saying they have to be doing this all the time, but there's always a temptation for them to say, well, we didn't get what we need to fulfill our institutional aspirations, and so therefore we need to raise tuition and push it onto the students as though somehow that's punishing the state of Connecticut and its government and its defense of its, you know, I mean, doesn't want to raise taxes to expand the revenues available for higher education. A reasonable decision. I'm not saying it's the right one. I don't know, but a reasonable decision. And then they're saying, "Well, we're going to have to take it out on the students and their families," and that is maybe one of the outcomes. But there's also the expense side. I mean, they control what they spend their money on.
The thing that because I don't know enough about Connecticut, but you know, and the other place we're facing is that at least one leg of that stool is also controlled by, you know, offices comparable to yours in terms of, or the state, in terms of policies related to, you know, pension liabilities, healthcare costs. So if I go back to picking on Louisiana, because it's far away, but Mike will know this, if you talk about every appropriated dollar in Louisiana, basically 60% of that, of each of those dollars going to an institution, are really essentially taxes offloaded by the state to pay for pension liabilities and health care. In fact, they're paying for health care because the faculty members and others are a younger generation than the rest of the...
That's not true in Connecticut.
Yeah, right, okay.
I would say that about, and this is a number off the top of my head, there probably is $250 to $300 million a year that is paid to represent the unfunded pension liability that is attributable to former and current employees at UConn and the Board of Regents. So we are paying probably 50% of our total block grants, again, or 40% of our total block grants, again, is going in toward that. Now, some of it we get back through the, you know, I mean, it's convoluted here, but there is a considerable, overall, there are hundreds of millions of dollars going for that. There are, all told, $1.5 billion a year going to take care of unfunded pension liabilities.
But it's partly, I just emphasize that because I think that the solution to this, you know, the expense side is really a shared responsibility. You know, it cuts across the whole system, you know, about how of a human resources. So if I haven't just dealt with that, and the number one issue in Ireland is that the government is insistent on improved productivity and expenditures in the system, but they have negotiated a labor agreement across the government linked to the Croke Park Agreement, which essentially restricts the institutions to be able to make any changes in personnel within limits. So what you've got is a real contrast between, you know, a challenge to meet high goals, but the degrees of freedom at the institutional level are really limited. And I'm not saying that's the case in Connecticut, but I really think it's helpful to put that on the table if you want to do this three-legged stool. Maybe I'm saying things that are not the case, but probably it needs to be a little bit thought of. But, okay, we're about to run out of time. If what I'd like to do is, we're looking at the notes to this meeting so that we come back, and Ben, I'll get Dennis to think about the first goal, too, to make sure, because if it doesn't communicate to you, that may be a slight problem. Maybe we can do a little better on that, okay? Okay. And then to pick up on the other comments we've gotten, you know, Judith, you've given us comments and others, so that we have the goals and a set of objectives of things that need to be overcome. And I think I didn't hear very many people objecting to the major theme that Mike emphasized about how the system is really going to be affordability, which is in fact the third goal here. What are the shares of financing between the state, the public, and I'll add the other one on terms of changing the modes of delivery within the system. And also greater sensitivity to the issue of quality, but I just want to have a caveat that that has a pretty diverse, we have to respect several different definitions. Yes, ma'am.
We have a lot of metrics, and we've been talking a lot about the first goal and the third goal, but if I'm looking at this 10 years, 20 years hence, I'm wondering what our way of measuring the success on the second goal really is, and if, in fact, advancement of competitiveness, global competitiveness, adds any value in the income equation, one, or if we should be talking about education for education's sake in the context of this in some way. So just quickly, yeah. Just
well, the education for education's sake, and in some respects, has to be part of one, too, because you really want to equip Connecticut residents, you know, for a complicated, you know, that. The other, I think, let me tell you, I will go back with Dennis on goal two. The easier to measure ones are the worst measures. I mean, the typical measure internationally on goal two is, in fact, number of publications generated and moving up rating scales. And Dennis suggested a measure that, in fact, related to the investment, for example, in research on connection with, in fact, change in the economy in Connecticut. The other issue, which you can understand and get beaten on in ways that the most difficult to measure is often very important in terms of the contribution of arts and culture to and how you really, but if those are off the table, then you really get at, you're really missing the contributions a lot of the public and independent institutions make in this state.
And I'd like to suggest that maybe distinctiveness is part of the marketing of our institutions and the marketability of our institutions.
Right.
And if we ignore that as part of the component, we may be missing something.
Right. Okay. Well, we do need to. Yes, ma'am.
I just have a question on our goals and seeing them after Ben sort of coming in and massaging them in a different way for us to see them in a different way, which is really helpful. I really connect the first one to the second one because it seems to me the reason why we're doing the 70 by 2025 is because so two is not a goal, it's a why we're doing it.
Yeah.
And the part that's also missing is about the individuals who we want them to be sustainable,
yeah,
and have
a life chance somewhere in a complicated world.
Right,
yeah.
And that's the piece. I mean, the reason we came up with the 70 number was because we knew that the jobs in 2025 are going to be, you know, are going to be jobs that require post-secondary education. And the people that are not in that 70% are the people that are being left behind now.
Right.
And
so it's beyond just the economy of Connecticut. They're just going to be generally left out if they're not, don't have some.
Well, they're left out, and they're also a drain on our economy.
Right.
I mean, if you look at the drain of social, you know, service programs and on Connecticut and the growth of that part of our budget. It is connected in terms of sustainability of our economy.
Mm-hmm.
But I really want it to be about the individual and mm-hmm. that the state has a responsibility to educate our population and our children so they can live, you know, sustainable and wonderful, you know, lives.
Let me go back and you may say we perseverated too much about the thing, but if any one of you, and particularly Ben in your position, look at this and say, you know, for heaven's sakes, this doesn't compute to me, I think we got to listen to that. And it may not, you know, it's got to be framed in a way that actually has some meaning. I think that's Okay, I think, Judy, we're going to meet on the...
There was a lot of going back and forth in terms of a date for November. For a variety of reasons, it is not our typical next meeting, and it because of Veterans Day. So we are going to, and I hope this works for the majority of people, move the meeting to Monday the 17th of November at our typical time. Hopefully that will work for people. So my guess is, based on some of this conversation that we've had here and individually, will help Ames and Dennis rewrite. And I know we've had some offers to help do that as well, too. But to recast some of the – to capture what we talked about today. So that's our goal at the 17th meeting, is to really have something that reflects that discussion.
Yeah, I think the draft you have reads much more like a report from NCHENS to the state about what we did rather than a strategic plan. And I think this is a chance to have something that really frames it in a different way. And we're also going to have some conversations with some of the presidents now before we have the meeting on the next time, so that we get as many people involved in this as possible.
Indeed, if hearing nothing else. Last questions, comments? Thank you for a robust discussion. We will see you in November. Thank you.